Good morning, and welcome to another in our series of mini shiurim on Megillas Esther. We're learning in the merit of the IDF, Israel's emergency services, the hostages, and the injured. And my plan is to have one more on Megillas Esther on Purim itself, with a really nice idea on Perek, on chapter 5. And then to switch, God willing, to Ezra and Nehemiah. And my thought is to do Ezra and Nehemiah culminating on Yom HaAtzma'ut. That would be my goal. For anyone who's not familiar, Ezra and Nehemiah record the return of the Jews to build the second Beis HaMikdash, to come back to Eretz Yisrael and develop Jewish life there. Really a remarkable set of stories and lessons that we can learn. So that's my goal after Purim. Some other time we can go through all the other options that I thought about. But right now, we're in Perek Hey. We're in chapter 5. And Esther is executing her plan to get Ahasuerus to a party and then to another party so that she can trap Haman. Interesting point that Professor Amos Chacham makes in the Dat Mikra on chapter 5. He says the two parties aren't only about putting Haman into a position where she's going to be able to expose him to Ahasuerus, but also she had said that she hadn't been invited in 30 days. So Amos Chacham suggests that she's trying to express to Ahasuerus that she feels neglected and that she wants him to pay attention to her. So come on, come to my party and then come to another party. Oh, that was a very interesting idea. That was number one. Number two, the Gemara in Megillah, Daf Tesvav Amud Beis, discusses the question of why Esther is inviting Haman to a party. What exactly is involved? And the Gemara actually brings a dozen reasons for why she does this. So I've reorganized those reasons that the Gemara gives just for the sake of clarity, to show the different perspectives on why she invites Haman. One school of thought is that she's inviting Haman in order to keep her options open. She's just hoping that something good is going to develop by inviting him, leaving herself a lot of different ways that could play out. So Rabbi Eliezer says that the goal is that the meal is somehow going to trap him. Just bring him there, hope he's going to make a mistake. Rabbi Yossi says she wants Haman to be around so that, again, she can trip him up somehow. Rabbi Yehuda says it's because she wants to avoid having people suspect that she is a Jew. Those are all within the idea that she's just kind of hoping something's going to develop and see what happens. A second point of view is that she's trying to manipulate Haman. So Rabbi Meir says she wants to make him complacent so that he won't realize she's working against him. Rabbah says she wants to make him arrogant, right? Make him feel like, I'm in control, I'm in charge, I got invited by the queen to the party, and so on. Rabbi Yeshua is stronger. She wants to make him an ally. Rabbi Yeshua says she understands that she needs to feed her enemy in order to make him a supporter. Ibn Ezra in Mishlei Chaf Hei has a similar idea to that. Another school of thought is within this that she's manipulating Ahasuerus. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says she wants to make Ahasuerus suspect impropriety between her and Haman, and that way he'll kill them both. That's her plan, according to Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. You could actually do a lot with that. According to the view in Tosos and Bava Basra, that Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha is either Rabbi Akiva or Rabbi Akiva's son, and you look at his strategy supporting Bar Kokhba against the Romans, this idea of, I may have to go down with the ship, but ultimately I'm going to save the Jews, may resonate. Also within this school of thought that she's manipulating Ahasuerus, Rabbi Lezer Hamodoi, she wants to make the king and the king's officers jealous of Haman's success. Rabbi Gamliel also has an idea within this, that she's manipulating Ahasuerus. He says, we know Ahasuerus flip-flops. Ahasuerus goes with whoever talks to him last, whatever he's feeling last. So she wants Haman close to hand when she speaks to Ahasuerus, so that Ahasuerus will have him killed right away. She doesn't want any gap in time, any opportunity for Haman to appeal. So she's manipulating Ahasuerus. Another school of thought, Rabbi Nehemiah, she is manipulating the Jews. She's worried that the Jews are relying on her too much to save them. So she pretends that she's actually on Haman's side, inviting him to the party to make the Jews more desperate. That's a very interesting approach. And then the last set of ideas is that she's manipulating Hashem. She's actually manipulating God. Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh says she wants Hashem to see this and to perform a miracle. Look at what I'm doing. Look how I have to degrade myself in order to save the Jews. And Hashem will be moved to act. Or alternatively, Abaye says, or Rabba says, that she has this idea that Hashem punishes the wicked at their feasts, just like King Belshazzar, the last Babylonian king, had his big feast and then lost the war to Persia and Media. So too, she figures Hashem will punish the wicked at their feasts. Hashem will punish Haman at the feast. So all of these different schools of thought, which I'll just recap the overall, either she's trying to just keep her options open, hoping something will work out. To use a hockey metaphor, she's just putting the puck in the zone and then hoping things will work. Or she's doing it to manipulate Haman, or she's doing it to manipulate Ahasuerus, or she's doing it to manipulate the Jews, or she's doing it to manipulate Hashem. And then the kicker in the Gemara, Eliyahu Hanavi speaks to Rabba Bar Avahu and says to him, actually, Esther had all of those reasons in mind when she did this. So that's one idea on Perek Hay, on chapter 5. A second point on chapter 5 is divine control. There's a theme found in Tanakh, how Hashem elevates the wicked in order to cast them down. If you think of Hannah's song after she has a child, right? In Shmuel Aleph, chapter 2, she has this beautiful song where she talks about how Hashem, yes, elevates people who are wicked, and then he brings them down. That's found in Tehillim quite a bit, including parts of Tehillim that seem to be quoting Hannah's song. You see it in Daniel with the Ark of King Nebuchadnezzar. So that's what happens here with Haman, and the Malbim points this out. He reaches the height of heights, and then with Esther inviting him to the party. As a matter of fact, Malbim has a comment in which he says, "Misaper gnus harasha hazev haroa tavuna so." He's talking about how the Megillah says that Haman was so happy when he got invited to the party. So the Malbim says that it's telling us the degradation of this wicked person and his horrible traits. Sha'ad ata, until now, b'chol hamalos asher alalo samach miyamav. He was never happy. We never saw Haman described as happy. He became the second in command in the kingdom. Everybody bows to him. He's never happy. Everything that he achieved, he's always looking for what's coming next. And whatever he achieved was low in his eyes. But that day, now I'm the equal of the king. I got invited to the party with Esther, with the king. Now he says, aha. I finally achieved something. And that's when he is described as being Sameach v'tov lev, happy and of good heart. Now finally he's happy. The Rav David Sabato spells this out. He says, look, first Ahasuerus became Mishneh LaMelech, second to the king. Then everybody bowed to him. Then he could issue a decree using the ring of the king. He could even destroy a nation. And then the queen invites him to a party with the king. He's just going up and up and up in heights. And finally, the king is going to say to him, what do I do to honor somebody who I want to honor? And that's when it all comes crashing down. I think you can also see this in the way that four events in the Megillah occur in pairs, but with opposite elements, a structure that demonstrates the divine plan. Meaning, Esther visits Ahasuerus the first time as a supplicant. The second time, she's in power. As a matter of fact, those who follow the laning, the notes, the trop, it says twice in the Megillah, "Vayoshet Hamelech LeEsther Shavit HaZahav," that the king extends to Esther the Shavit HaZahav, the gold scepter. But the first time it does it, it's Vayoshet Hamelech. It's this very excited thing. Whereas the second time, it's Vayoshet Hamelech. It's kind of low key. The king just did it. But that's one pairing: Esther's visit to Achashverosh first as a supplicant, and then the second time as somebody in power. Esther has two parties. The first one is a source of joy for Haman, like we just said, Sameach v'tov lev. He's really happy, and the second one destroys him. The third pair, Haman's family meetings. The first one is to destroy Mordechai, and the second one is that Mordechai will destroy him. Right, when he hears from his family that Mordechai is going to destroy him. And finally, Haman's two meetings with Achashverosh. His first one results in the decree against the Jews, and then the second one results in him parading Mordechai around the city. So things that occur in pairs, highlighting the fact that first he was on the ascendancy, and then he comes crashing down. So there's a lot to say on this parak, but what I want to discuss, God willing, in the recording that will come out on Purim, will be the 50 Amma gallows, and what exactly is going on, why a 50 Amma gallows, what was the goal here. So that will be, God willing, the Purim one, and then, like I said, we'll go on to Ezra and Nehemiah.